I like the tip, not like the top. I love you better, baby, than all the left slop, cause I'm a big-legged woman with my short, short mini skirt.
Sings Twyla Bird's song. Her roots are in the blues, but she does some jazz, she does some soul, she does some rock, and she is our Live Music Friday guest here today on WKAR's Current State. We look forward to hearing more from Twyla and her band, Steve Frog Forgy, Angel Daughtery, Mike Smalley, and Boonie Daughtery, all in the studio today. More throughout the course of the hour. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's a Friday edition of Current State on 90.5 WKAR. To begin the program today, for most of the last 2 years, the capital city's publicly owned utility, the Lansing Board of Water and Light, has been under the closest scrutiny ever. The community's harsh assessment of the utility's slow response to power outages following an intense ice storm 2 years ago triggered well over 100 reforms. Now, almost 2 years after the storm, the Lansing Board of Water and Light has issued its final report. It summarizes the reforms, which fall into four broad categories: emergency preparedness, operations, communication, and technology. It was publicly released last evening. To discuss, we welcome David Price, chair of the board that oversees the BWL. Welcome back, David.
Thank you for being here.
And also General Michael McDaniel, chair of the BWL Community Review Team. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Mark. You too.
Let me ask you first, this report is coming from whom exactly? Who assembled this?
The report was actually assembled by the management of BWL. It was the response to the community review team. In addition, the Michigan Public Service Commission had recommendations as well. Mm-hmm. So we thought it was time and appropriate time to tell the community that we took those reports very, very seriously.
Did the board have any input, or was this just the management team?
We've had input all along on this, and again, this was sort of the, you know, take our pulse. Here's what we've done so far. We've completed many things. Many things will be ongoing, but the fact of the matter is, the response that occurred 2 years ago will not occur again because of these improvements.
There are a ton of questions I could ask, but I want to spend some time on the status of the outage management system. Just last month, a BWL internal audit revealed that it never performed as promised and was described as fragile and unstable by the project manager that oversaw its installation. That system failed during the ice storm, but it is still the system in use at the Board of Water and Light today. It is the utility equipped with an outage management system that the community can depend on?
Yes. The system has been fixed. It has been stress tested to beyond the outage that we experienced in the 2013 ice storm. And we also have in place a manual redundant system in the event that the outage management system has any kind of failure again, although we don't expect that.
General McDaniel, what do you make of the status of the outage management system right now?
I'm still not convinced that it's as robust and has full capability. I mean, the as you mentioned, Mark, the performance audit from just last month said that they need to test it more. That's the same thing we said in our report in May of 2014. And then the second thing is that the backup system is a manual system. We need system redundancy. So they need to have another, I mean, in our business, redundancy is a good thing. Something's going to fail, so you have to have a backup system so that you are still online.
Price did allude to redundancy, though. There is some degree of redundancy built into the system.
Well, they're using a manual backup system. Manual means just that. We're using folks to enter data as our backup system. That's what we ended up doing during the last blackout in December of 2013. that didn't work so well. So there are plans in place to build a redundant electronic system as part of a larger system, but we're not there yet, and the sooner the better with that.
The general's correct, and we support that as a board and as the management staff as well.
So. But General McDaniel, what do you make of the stress testing that Dave Price just referred to here? Is that not enough to convince you that this system is sound, or?
Well, it's stress testing, they're doing it twice a year, spring and fall, before you hit the two weather event seasons. I'm not convinced that that's enough because I don't think it puts enough focus upon the need for that system. Everything hinges upon that system. You know, if that system's in place, then everything else will fall in line. So there's an awful lot of reliance for the entire system of response to work, that system, and then restoration. That system has to be working in top-notch condition.
But the system, the outage management system the utility has now, is the system that will be in operation,
it's in operation
this winter and next winter.
It's in operation right now. And, you know, after we had the internal audit report presented to the board, both the board and management expressed their concern going forward that this is something we're going to have to address. There's no question about it. There'll be additional costs. We don't know what those will be, but it will be at a level where it has a redundancy built in that's not a manual system, and it'll probably replace the OMS with something that's even better. But we're confident at this point that if something occurred today, that system will work. Is it the best system available? Maybe not.
Sounds like General McDaniel doesn't share quite the degree of confidence you do.
And that's okay. We may agree to disagree on this one at this point.
Okay. Now, I understand the utility will be getting a new outage management system, but not before 2017. What can you tell us about that?
At this point, it has the RFP has not been created for that system, so we don't know who the potential vendors might be or what that cost is.
Did the BWL's internal audit uncover something that the community review team missed, General McDaniel?
If it did, I'm not aware of it. The internal audit of this past October had three main points. It was the procurement process. It was the need to fully stress test the system. And the third one was the redundant system.
But did the community review team, Were you able to learn how much doubt there was about the GE outage management system during your phase of the investigation? Or did things come from the internal audit that you were not aware of?
Well, certainly there was a frustration on the part of the community review team with the receipt of documents at that point in time. And I don't know that we ever got all the documents that we had asked for. But in terms of the OMS, I mean, in the process there, that's past history in the sense that both the Public Service Commission and the Internal Audit have now agreed with the recommendations that was in the report by the Community Review Team.
I'm curious what we may have known sooner if the audit had taken place sooner. And Dave Price, I take it there was a desire from some board members for an internal audit throughout last year, 2014, but that didn't happen. Why not?
Well, I think we had a different board back then that might not have been quite so willing to revisit the past. But I think there were a couple of us on the board who Dennis Lowney, who is our vice chair this year, kept kind of plugging away at that and saying, this is something we need to look at. This was a key component of the failure in our response to the ice storm. And with some changes on the board, that allowed that to go forward.
One more question about the audit, and we'll move on because there's a lot in the report. Given what the audit clarified and revealed, talk to me about what should determine whether an internal audit like this takes place.
Well, it really falls in the board. The board has three employees and three employees only, and one of those employees, in addition to the general manager and our corporate secretary, is our internal auditor. And the internal auditor functions at the direction of the board. So it was the previous board that didn't see a need, perhaps, to go that way, but the current board and decided, yes, that was something we needed.
What do you make of that, General McDaniel, in terms of the BWL auditing itself?
Well, it's ultimately responsible to, well, first and foremost, the citizens of the city of Lansing, which own the BWL, and then to the customers as well, through the fact that the board has to report to the city council and to the mayor. So I would say, though, that I agree with David that we have a much more empowered board. What the board learned from this event was we can't just accept the report from the general manager, mm-hmm. that we have to question whatever we receive and ask those sort of critical questions, and that's being done.
But did Peter Lark actively resist an internal audit, and is Dick Pefley more receptive to the idea of an internal audit?
I can't respond to the first question because I wasn't, even though I was on the board, those questions weren't raised when I was on the board then. So I can't say that there was resistance. I will tell you that under Dick Pefley, anything we have brought to him for whether it's an internal audit, any kind of audit, he is more than receptive and more than open to any questions we have from any board members or from the internal auditor.
David Price is chair of the board that oversees the Board of Water and Light. General Michael McDaniel is chair of the BWL Community Review Team. Lots of reforms to look back on here on what appears to be a related note. The utility is adding more than 300 spotters to watch for down lines. That's from among existing employees. Talk to me about that.
It was one of the criticisms from the community review team is we didn't have enough boots on the ground trying to figure out what happened. The outage management system had failed, so then you have to have people out there. So we have trained our own staff, people who don't necessarily normally work out in the field, but they are trained to go out and be spotters, and then the spotters can then call in and say, here's the issue in this neighborhood or that neighborhood, and then we can direct the repair teams based on what those spotters are telling us.
General McDaniel, does that soften any doubts you might have about the outage management system, that we have hundreds of spotters now employed in looking for downed lines?
I'm still concerned that that could be a bottleneck, and here's the reason. We are talking about having individuals out there on the ground. You still have to have all that information then from them collected either electronically or manually by a phone call, and then it's got to be recorded by a person. It's got to be put into some sort of spreadsheet. That's an unwieldy system. That's what we did in December of 13. So it is definitely a step forward in this way, because by training all of their staff as spotters, they have changed the corporate culture. Everyone on BWL realizes that if we have an outage of significance, it's all in. Everyone's engaged. Everyone's trained. Everyone knows that if there is an emergency or some form of outage event, that they will be involved. So that's really changed the corporate culture with that training, with understanding that they always have a role. But it's still a manual system. The idea is, and was in our recommendations, that they would do smart metering, that you would have a system so that as soon as the power is out at an individual residence through smart metering, they would know that electronically. And that is much more efficient, much, much quicker, and will add to a greater response. That system is being factored in. They've started with a few thousand homes thus far as a pilot. They have plans to move that forward over the next 6 years. I absolutely applaud that. It's definitely the way to go. There's been some community resistance, but smart metering is absolutely the way to go. Mm-hmm.
Will the management continue to respond to the kinds of doubts that General McDaniel is expressing here, or are you going to agree to disagree?
No, we value the general's opinion greatly. And last night, I think you saw the response. The general said some of these same things last night at the community meeting, and there was a lot of nodding and agreement coming from the management team of BWL on these issues.
What was the report largely about satisfying somebody? Was it largely about satisfying you, General McDaniel, or the mayor or the city council?
Oh, I don't think so at all. Certainly there was a reference to specific recommendations in the community review team's report, but it was mostly to let the public know the BWL steps forward in terms of both preparedness and in terms of innovation. I was very, very impressed with the strides that they have made in the last year and a half, no question. For example, it's not really in the report, but one of the things that was specifically mentioned last night was that as part of the $100 million improvement to transmission and distribution, we're going to smaller but more substations. So we are creating sort of a micro network. And the good thing about that is if you lose one little substation of 10 megawatts or so, then you've got all the others. You won't have the cascading effects where one substation goes down, then the other one has to take on that load as well, that power demand as well. By doing that, they are creating these little pocket grids by neighborhood almost, and that will make a much more robust system.
Mm-hmm. David Price, we have regrettably too little time to address this topic. Let me give you a chance to just summarize what was in the report and how you feel about moving forward.
Well, sure. I think a couple of things that are critical. One, we hired Trent Atkins from the city as our emergency manager. We didn't have that in place. One of the criticisms wasn't just how the BWL responded, but how the communities around us and that are part of us responded. That's being addressed. Trent is developing partnerships so that we have a coordinated and consistent response if we're ever faced with an emergency like this again. Operationally, more boots on the ground, more tree trimming. We have 37 crews out trimming trees. There were 2,400 lines brought down during the ice storm. Those were all brought down by tree limbs that broke because of the heavy ice load. So that has been addressed. We have more agreements with other power companies to respond with us if there's an emergency. And we have contracts in place for private entities that can come in as well. We go into emergency mode days before a potential outage event, a storm. So, and at that time, those contractors are put on alert. They're sort of wed to us until we release them. So,
General McDaniel, yes.
One last point. Remember that this is a publicly owned utility, the largest in the state of Michigan. And what is unique about the Board of Water and Light is that we have the ability to generate all our own power. We are not dependent upon outside power. That is a wonderful thing, that we are energy self-reliant in this area. We should be attracting businesses based upon that we can guarantee that they will have all the power that they need, and we can do it at lower than market cost.
Is the community review team's work done at this point, or is there a role for the CRT in the future?
Well, I'd like it to be done, but Dick Peffley, the general manager, asked me to continue on when I raised a few suggestions last night, one of which is how do we assure that our community understands the need for energy self-reliance, and how do we build out this new improved transmission and distribution system over the next 6 years?
We want to thank General Michael McDaniel, Chair of the Board of Water and Light Community Review Team, also David Price, Chair of the Board that oversees the BWL. We've been talking about the final report, the challenges that have been addressed, the challenges that remain. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Two, three, four, one.
You stay out all night till the break of day. Snap me up with everything I say. Little by little, oh, I'm losing you, I can't see. Ooh, yeah. And bit by bit, baby, your love is slipping away from me. What you doing that it takes all night? Little by little, oh, I'm losing you, I can see. Ooh, oh, and bit by bit, baby, your love is slipping away from me. Oh, and I say, oh, 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 baby, that's the way I feel. Mm-hmm. I say, oh. Oh, baby, that's the way I feel.
Twyla Birdsong and her band here live in Studio S on WKAR's Current State. Live Music Friday. We'll talk with Twyla and members of her band coming up in just a little bit. And she was this year's Capital Area Blues Society competition winner. So congratulations to Twyla, and more from her coming up in just a little bit. It's Ohio State weekend for the Michigan State Spartans. We are 13 points on the wrong side of the line, as it turns out. 3:30 kick tomorrow in Columbus. I'm wondering how many Spartans are remembering 1998, though, today. I am one of them. We're getting some thumbs up in the studio here on that. That was an extraordinary day when the Spartans came out victorious at the Horseshoe, a very vivid memory. Everybody remembers where they were when they found out the Spartans won that day. Hopefully we can repeat that experience tomorrow. It's 90.5 WKAR. On November 26, 1865, English mathematician Charles Dodgson, you might know him better as Lewis Carroll, published Alice in Wonderland. The iconic children's book went on to influence everyone from surrealist painters to psychedelic rock bands. In honor of its 150th birthday, the MSU Library has pulled together an exhibit of Alice-related materials from its collection. Current State's April Van Buren is here to tell us more. Merry unbirthday to you, April.
And a very merry unbirthday to you, Mark. Coincidentally, that happens to be the name of this particular exhibit, which runs through January 15th at MSU's main library. And I met up with Andrew Lundin, who's the curator of the exhibit and who also does work in special collections at the library. And we talked about Alice's influential legacy that you mentioned. And he started by describing for me some of the materials featured in the exhibit.
So we have a range of material sort of showing the entire influence of Alice. So we have a number of early pieces. For example, we have a rare second edition of Alice published in late 1865. We have a facsimile copy, a 20th century facsimile of Lewis Carroll's original manuscript for Alice in Wonderland, and that shows some of his early illustrations of the character of Alice, kind of gives a sneak peek into his thought process in creating the work. We also have a number of works influenced by Alice, either directly or indirectly. So we have a huge collection of comic books. I don't know if you know this, but MSU Special Collections actually has one of the world's largest, if not the largest, collection of comic books and graphic novels in the world. So we had quite a few related to Alice in Wonderland, some comic book adaptations for children, and also some graphic novels for a more adult audience. We even have a erotic parody comic that's quite racy. So really, a whole range of material.
How influential was Alice in Wonderland and those original illustrations on artists, whether visual or comic book artist, after Lewis Carroll published it?
Yeah, well, Alice in Wonderland was hugely influential, I think, for a variety of reasons. On the one hand, Lewis Carroll's original language was so colorful and so imaginative and so whimsical that it inspired people's imaginations just to run wild. And on the other hand, the original illustrations for the first published edition were by John Tenniel, a very popular political cartoonist and also a children's book illustrator of the era. And those have gone on to be iconic in their own right and has served as the inspiration for a lot of Alice adaptations to come.
And so when you were putting together this exhibit, how did you choose which pieces you wanted to include?
So on the one hand, we were limited by space, of course, and also limited by the items that we had in the collection. But when it came down to picking and choosing, I wanted to select items that were both representative of Alice. I mean, this is the 150th anniversary, so I wanted a historical look, for example, our early second edition. And I also wanted to show the significant influence that it's had over the years. So we selected a variety of the comic book adaptations, like I said, a number of illustrated editions put out by really well-known artists over the years, like Salvador Dali, who did one in the 60s, Ralph Steadman, best known for collaborating with Hunter S. Thompson in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and other works, and also the surprising influence that Alice had on political propaganda as well. We have a number of works spanning the entire 20th and the 21st century up to now that co-opt, I guess you could say, the language of Alice in Wonderland to make a political point.
Could you give me an example of one of those?
Yeah, so one really interesting one that we have, one of my personal favorites in the collection, is a 1939 work called Adolf in Blunderland. And it's about Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime, and it's very critical of Nazi Germany, and it sort of portrays Hitler as this kind of bumbling, naive, childlike character who is sort of fumbling his way through managing Germany. And it's really quite striking because there are a number of illustrations in the work, and they make you do a double take when you look at them because they take the iconic imagery of the original, for example, the Queen of Hearts and her playing card soldiers, and the playing cards have as their suit a swastika. So it's quite striking and historically interesting.
I'm talking with Andrew Lundeen at the MSU Library. We're talking about an exhibit that celebrates the 150th anniversary of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. And Andrew, I want to go back a little and talk about sort of the history of Alice in Wonderland. Lewis Carroll didn't start as a children's book author. He was actually a mathematician. What do we know about sort of the origin story of how he goes from a mathematician to one of the world's, you know, most beloved children's authors?
Well, you're right. He was a mathematician and a lecturer at Christ Church in Oxford, but he was also known as sort of a friend to children, and he would often entertain the daughters of the dean of his college. He would take them on picnics and on boating trips and would spin wild tales of adventure and talking animals. And so the story goes that on one such boating trip, he told this story of a little girl named Alice who fell down a rabbit hole into a world of wonder and mystery. And his friends and colleagues liked it so much, and the children liked it so much, that he was urged to send it to the publisher. And he did, and, well, the rest is history.
Was it as popular a book when it was first published? Because I think today it's become such iconic book, such a part of, you know, our cultural history. Did it make that big of a splash when it was first published?
Well, it did make a big splash. Lewis Carroll actually lamented sometimes having written it because he went from being this very mild-mannered lecturer to an overnight, maybe not overnight, but to, you know, a success story, and was inundated with letters and meeting requests from fans, much like a popular author of today would be. And so, yeah, it was hugely influential. You know, the world of children's literature before Alice Wonderland is really a different landscape. The children's books of the time were more morality tales. They had a moral, and they were aimed at instilling good Victorian morals and practices in their young readers. Alice in Wonderland was one of the first books to actually celebrate childhood and to celebrate fun and the imagination and nonsense. So in that way, it was one of the very first modern children's books, you could say.
And it's interesting because obviously it starts as this children's book, but it's had huge appeal for adult audiences too. I mean, you mentioned the erotic parodies of it in these comic books. Right. You have people who think of it as these metaphors for all these different kinds of drugs. Why do you think it's been so influential beyond just the sphere of children's literature, that it's had this influence on all kinds of culture?
Well, I think there's just something in it that appeals to all of our sense of wonder and imagination. The language is so clever, and the imagery is so whimsical and so playful that I think that it really just speaks to something in all of us.
I'm here with Andrew Lundeen at the MSU Library. We've been talking about A Very Merry Unbirthday, which is an exhibition celebrating the 150th anniversary of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. Andrew, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, April.
A very merry unbirthday to me.
To who?
To me.
Oh, you.
A very merry unbirthday to you.
Oh, me?
Yes, you.
Oh, me.
And congratulate us with another cup of tea. A very merry
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR, our live music Friday edition. More from Twyla Birdsong and her band coming up in just a little bit. I'm Mark Bayshore. In 2009, Wayne County officials made a shocking discovery at the Detroit Police Department. A county assistant prosecutor noticed stacks upon stacks of rape kits on the shelves. Those rape kits contain DNA evidence taken from survivors of sexual assault. All in all, there were more than 11,000, and some of them had been in storage for 30 years. They had never been tested or investigated. After this came to light, a number of women stepped up to tackle the problem. An organization called Enough Said, which stands for Enough Sexual Assault in Detroit, was formed to raise private sector funding for investigation of the kits and prosecution of the resulting cases. Joining us by phone today are two of those women. Joanna Klein is the chief marketing officer at Fathead, a graphics and decal business in Detroit. She was instrumental in raising awareness about the untested kits and getting local businesses involved. Joanna, welcome to Current State.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And Margaret Tallett is the Chief Community Engagement Officer of the Michigan Women's Foundation, which has been leading the Enough Said effort. Margaret, welcome.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here.
We are glad to have both of you about this amazing and unforgettable story here that you have tackled. Joanna, how did you find out about the backlog of rape kits at the Detroit Police Department? What was that like learning that?
Back in March of 2013, I was watching the NBC news program Rock Center, and Prosecutor Worthy was a guest talking about the backlog of rape kits in Detroit. And I had not heard anything about this issue until then, and I was shocked and horrified, as quite frankly I still am, that something like this could happen.
What did you do? What was your first step?
The first thing that I did was I started to research more about the issue. I wanted to learn more about the rape kits in Detroit. I wanted to understand if this was specific to Detroit or a national issue, and understand what was needed to help Detroit address this issue. And what I learned was the biggest thing that was needed was funds. At the time, it was funds for testing, investigation, and prosecution. And as you mentioned, now we're really focused on the investigation and prosecution. And so what I did was I sent an email to about 250 business leaders here in the Detroit area explaining what the issue was, talking about how I thought we could make an impact, and asking if anyone was interested in helping.
Peg Tallett, how did the Michigan Women's Foundation get involved in this?
You know, Kim Worthy, the elected prosecutor in Wayne County, took this nationally. She brought it out into the focus, and this is how Joanna and others found out about it and admitted that Detroit had this problem. Simultaneously, across the nation, literally, jurisdictions everywhere came forward and said, unfortunately, us too. So we know of 400,000 untested kits. There are probably many, many more. Mm. Kim then went literally door to door seeking funding. Clearly, Detroit was not able to tackle this. Wayne County wasn't able to tackle this. The state wasn't able to tackle it alone. And she literally went to the private sector and said, who can help? When she came to Michigan Women's Foundation in the spring of 2014, we said, oh my gosh, you know, Michigan Women's Foundation's tagline is, we are the foundation on which Michigan women and girls thrive. We cannot thrive if we are not safe. So we set out to find a way to make this happen. Our concern was that at that point we were small. There were only four of us on the team, and we really didn't have the bench strength, if you would, or the resources to take it on. Hudson Weber Foundation came forward and said, if you guys can pull together a team, tell us what you need, we'll try to get you funded, and then we'll figure out how to do this going forward. So in June of 2014, the Board of Michigan Women's Foundation unanimously approved taking this on, and we reached out to Joanna and the early adopters, as we call the founders group, and we said, let's get this done together. But our thinking from the get-go was that this needs to be a private-public partnership. Truly, this is failure of government, and it's difficult to ask even the best-hearted individuals and families and corporations to step forward to take care of a mistake that government has created. So we decided, in fact, to get as many people as we could to make a statement that this was important, and then to utilize that to leverage and to draw attention in the public sector.
We have some numbers here that show the results of your efforts and the efforts of Enough Said. The Wayne County Prosecuting Attorney's Office says so far they've identified 652 people suspected of being serial sexual assault offenders, and they've secured 27 convictions, 182 more cases are being investigated, and nearly 1,600 more are awaiting investigation. Joanna, have you personally heard from any of the victims about how they've been impacted by having their cases investigated?
I was humbled to be at an event in March of 2014 where one of the survivors spoke about her experiences and what it meant to her to have had her evidence treated so carelessly and, you know, now the efforts to do right by the survivors and get these offenders off the street. And like I said, it was a humbling experience and certainly motivating.
I cannot begin to get my head around what it must have been like to be someone assaulted decades ago and to have had no action taken on that all these years. It's still astounding that this took place at all. Peg, there are still more kits to be tested. How much needs to be raised to get all of them tested?
The remaining testing is about $650,000. But the real issue now is the investigation. The number that you just gave of how many, you know, almost 1,600 cases awaiting investigation, that's the critical number at this point. We have got to get everyone behind this effort on every level of government. You may have just heard that Warren Evans, the Wayne County executive, just came forward with $1 million for this. This was an amazing commitment from the county, which, as you know, is struggling financially. But he felt it was important to put some skin in the game. We've encouraged him to do this each year for the next 5 years as we get through this. But it's estimated that there's probably another $14 million of need. These people who have been put into the CODIS system, more than half of them already existed in CODIS, for having committed violent crimes in 39 states. So this will be a nationwide manhunt. It is an expensive but critical proposition to find these men and get them off the street. The average rapist rapes between 7 and 11 times, which means that if we take them off the street after the first assault, we will save perhaps a dozen women from this horrible, horrible crime.
We're speaking with Peg Tallett and Joanna Klein of Enough Said, a collaboration that raises private funding to test Detroit's forgotten rape kits, investigate the crimes, and prosecute cases. Joanna, why do you think such a backlog accumulated? How did this happen?
You know, what I will say is that this is a sin of the past, and I think that Detroit has taken tremendous strides to make sure that this doesn't happen again. But quite frankly, I think it speaks a lot to the way we treat these crimes, the way we treat victims of sexual assault, and it's a really unfortunate statement on how these survivors were viewed at the time.
Peg, how do you feel about Detroit's ability to keep this in check in the future?
On the 26th of June in 2014, Governor Snyder signed a bill that was approved unanimously by both houses in Lansing, requiring medical facilities and police stations, police jurisdictions, to submit a sexual assault kit within 15 days of it being taken, so in 15 days of the crime. They must submit it to a approved laboratory, and when the results come back, they have a very limited amount of time to begin the investigation. Kim Worthy assures us that she has the manpower and the team, and they are committed to getting these done in a timely way going forward. That team is just phenomenal. I have all the faith in the world in them. We're acting to clean up the backlog in the cold case unit.
Joanna, how can people get involved to help the rest of these kits get tested and the cases prosecuted? Is the heart of your effort about raising dollars?
Absolutely. Raising dollars and raising awareness. So people can visit Enough Said Detroit, can visit the website and make personal donations. Through CrowdRise, there's also an opportunity for people to fundraise. So take to Facebook, take to social media, and, you know, galvanize your network to help you fundraise for this issue and build awareness.
We have been speaking about untested rape kits in Detroit with Joanna Klein of Enough Said and with Peg Tallett. Also involved in the effort, Enough Said is a collaboration that raises private funding to test the kits and investigate and prosecute cases. Peg, Joanna, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's Current State on WKAR. I want to point out, check out Current State online at WKAR.org for our final installment of Geography Awareness Week. There you will hear MSU Associate Professor Leo Zulu tell us about how his experience creates connections between the physical geography of forestry and social geography. It is Geo Week in Mid-Michigan. That is a WKAR, a Current State web extra. It's also a Live Music Friday. This year's Capital Area Blues Society competition winner, Twyla Birdsong, is our special guest here today, and we have enjoyed the performances so far. We've got another one ready to go. This is called I'm On Your Side.
Get with me, baby. I'm on your side. Me, baby, I'm on your side. Well, there's a change in the weather, change in the time, but I'm a stubborn woman, I won't change my mind. Get with me, baby.
Twyla Birdsong here on Live Music Friday on WKAR. We want to acknowledge the band as well. SJ Forgy, welcome back, Frog. Good to see you. Your name has been dropped a few times in a few of these songs today. It's no secret that Frog is with us. Angel Daugherty, Mike Smalley, and Clarence Booney Daugherty. Congratulations on winning the Blue Society competition.
Thanks.
That's a special feeling, I imagine. And tell our listeners about yourself. How'd you become involved in singing and in music?
Well, I started out in the church singing gospel in the choir.
In Lansing?
Choir. Actually, it was in Lansing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then...
What church?
Well, should I say the church and then I'm singing blues? Well... Pentecostal. It used to be called Pentecostal Church of God in Christ.
Okay.
But it's now Tabernacle of David. They changed the name. But,
okay.
Yep, Sunshine Band, Purity Class, and all of that.
So you're a Lansing native. You've been here your whole life?
I'm actually not a native. I'm a transplant from Michigan City, Indiana. But I definitely consider Lansing my home, Lansing pride. I love Lansing.
Did you grow up in a musical family?
My mom, she played the guitar for the church growing up, and she actually plays the harmonica, too. She won't teach me how to play either, though.
Yep. So is your earliest memory involving music related to the church? Or?
It is. Okay. Yep. Listening to Mahalia Jackson on the radio, records? They used to be called records.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I've read about those.
Records. And Mighty Clouds of Joy and Shirley Caesar, Andre Crouch. That's what I used to grow up listening
but
to.
You've mostly performed the blues, is that right?
Correct.
But
so
according to your bio, you've been flirting with jazz more recently, though, too.
Yeah.
You're diversifying your...
Yes, within this last 4 years. And that's how me and Mike I've met Mike through... He was going through the jazz program, Mike Smalley. And
your bass player.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You have a big date coming up in January, a spot in the quarterfinals of the International Blues Challenge. Tell us what you know about that.
Well, actually, this is my third time going down there. The first time I went as a band with the Hoopties. And then the first time I didn't really take in that experience, and I wanted to go again. So I had to enter as a duo. And I went with Mike Aiyah. And so this is my third time with these guys, my first time with these guys going down there. And we're looking to win.
And this is in Memphis.
Yes, in Memphis. And there it says International Blues Challenge, and there's definitely people from all over the world. It's kind of amazing to hear someone speaking German, and then they start with the blues, and it's crazy.
I imagine. What does the winner get? What do you get out of this if you're successful?
What do they get? Frog is, he had to...
The winner gets... All right. The winner gets a lot of promotion, of course, and they get them some work. You know, it's not like we're going to make a record for you or anything like that. I don't think it's an American Idol, but it's definitely, you know, it's a feather in your cap. Mm-hmm. And several people who have won it over the course of the last dozen years or so have done very well from it.
Twyla Birdsong is our Live Music Friday guest today. In January, she will represent Lansing at the International Blues Challenge in Memphis. You mentioned your band, the Hoopties. Are the Hoopties still together?
They are still together. We do something together probably two, three times a year. But the Hoopties is, they do other engagements without me also.
And talk to us briefly about about your players here today. Identify the band.
Well, I've known Frog for years, but we did a couple of things together, but I'm so glad to be doing this combination. Steve, I know him by Frog, Forgery. And then Mike Smalley. We've been together now, I think, 3 years doing jazz and blues. We did a cool Christmas concert. And the same with Angel Dottery. She's on support vocals. I don't say background vocals.
It's great to have more than one voice going on because we've been at this almost 3 years and we don't do support vocals, mm-hmm. as you put it, that often here. It's great to have the voices interacting
with
each other.
I love it. They really push me. Mm-hmm. And then we have Clarence Dottery on drums.
Very good. Well, you're a tight unit. We want to have you play us out here in just a few minutes after I remind our listeners that Monday on Current State, the Civil War battle at Antietam has been described as America's bloodiest day. Michigan authors Jack Dempsey and Brian James Egan have written the story of the role played by soldiers and civilians from our state, Michigan at Antietam. We'll talk with the authors and a ton more set to go on Monday here on Current State. We want to thank Katie Cook, who directed our show today, also Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Peter Worf is the executive producer of Current State. We'll leave it at that, and we will look for everybody on Monday here on WKAR's Current State. Twyla Birdsong and her band plays us out. Have a great weekend.
never knew how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you wrap your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
Fever.
Oh, you give me fever.
Fever.
Fever in the morning, child. Fever all through the night. Sun lights up the daytime. Moon lights up the night. My eyes light up when you call my name. I know you're gonna treat me right. You give me fever.